shining veil and headscarf. However, no one looked at her. She had become what she'd been trying to become ever since the beginning of this journey. Invisible. Combined with the dowdy, depressed way of moving recommended by Anita Schlesinger, the veil made her actively resistant to other people's interest. Men in particular walked in front of her, as if she had no more substance or importance than a shadow, barged ahead at street crossings, took no notice at all. And little by little, she began to feel a kind of freedom in this state. It was hot, though, and getting hotter as the sun rose higher. She made her way towards where she thought the center of the city must be, in the direction of more traffic, more noise, bigger shops, and more crowded streets. At some point, she thought, she might find someone who spoke English. There were large numbers of armed police, some sitting on the pavement playing dice, some standing, scrutinizing every passerby, some inspecting the items a poor hawker was trying to sell from his suitcase, others eating and drinking at a food stall placed illegally in the road. Lyra watched them closely, and felt their eyes when they did deign to notice her. A brief, incurious flick at her hidden face, the automatic and inevitable glance at her body, then the look away. Not even her lack of a demon provoked a glimmer of attention. Despite the heat, it really was almost like being liberated. As well as the police, there were soldiers sitting in armored cars, or patrolling with guns held across their chests. They looked as if they were waiting for an uprising they knew was coming, but didn't know when. At one point, Lyra nearly walked into a squad who seemed to be interrogating a group of boys, some so young that their demons kept flickering between one abject form and another, trying to appease the men with guns and faces ablaze with anger. One boy dropped to his knees and held his hands out, pleading, only for a rifle butt to slam into the side of his head and drop him on the road. Lyra very nearly cried out, "No!" and had to hold herself back from running up to protest. The boy's demon had changed into a snake, and squirmed brokenly in the dust until the soldier's demon put a heavy foot on her, and she and the boy fell still. The soldiers were aware that Lyra was watching. The man who'd hit the boy looked up and shouted something, and she turned and walked away. She hated being helpless, but the thought of this man's violence made her feel every bruise, every cut from the attack on the train, and the memory of those hands thrusting up inside her skirt made her very entrails cold with repugnance. Her first task was to get out of this place alive and active, and that meant remaining inconspicuous, however hard that was. She moved on further into the busy streets, into an area of shops and small businesses, repairers of furniture, sellers of second-hand bicycles, makers of cheap clothing and the like. Always the presence of the police. Always the sight of soldiers. She wondered about relations between the two forces. They seemed to be keeping scrupulously apart, with a formal politeness when they had to pass one another on the street. She wished Bud Schlesinger would suddenly appear to guide her calmly through the maze of difficulties here, or Anita to keep her cheerful with encouragement and conversation, or Malcolm. She let that thought linger until it faded. The closer she came to the center of the city, the more she felt uncomfortable, because the pain in her left hand got a little worse with each throb of blood through the arteries near her broken bone. She looked at every shop sign, every notice board, every brass plate on every building, looking for a sign that might mean English was spoken there. In the end, the sign she found was on an oratory. A little limestone basilica, roofed with red-brown terracotta tiles in a dusty graveyard where three olive trees grew out of the gravel, bore a wooden sign that said in English, French, and Arabic, "The Holy Chapel of Saint Fenurios," followed by a list of the times of services and the name of the priest in charge, a Father Jerome Burnaby. The Princess Cantacuzino. Hadn't she said that her demon was called Fenurios? Lyra stopped to look into the enclosure. Beside the basilica stood a little house in a palm-shaded garden, where a man in faded blue shirt and trousers was watering some flowers. He looked up as she watched and gave a cheerful wave. And encouraged by this, Lyra moved cautiously towards him. He put down his watering can and said, "Assalamu alaikum." She went a little closer, into the garden itself, which was rich with many kinds of green leaves, but where the only flowers were deep red. "Wa alaikum assalam," she said quietly. "Do you speak English?"
"Yes, I do. I'm the priest in charge here, Father Burnaby. I'm English. Are you? You sound English."
He sounded as if he came originally from Yorkshire. His demon was a robin, who watched Lyra from the handle of the watering can with her head cocked. The priest himself was burly and red-faced, older than she'd thought from the road, and his expression radiated a shrewd kind of concern. He reached out a hand to steady her as she stumbled over a stone. "Thank you."
"Are you all right? You don't look well. Not that it's easy to tell."
"May I sit down?"
"Come with me."
He led her into the house, where it was a little cooler than outside. As soon as the door closed behind her, Lyra unwound the headscarf veil and took it off with relief.
"What have you been doing to yourself?"
he said, taken aback by the cuts and the bruising on her face. "I was attacked, but I just need to find..."
"You need a doctor."
"No, please. Let me just sit down for a minute. I'd rather not."
"Well, you can have a glass of water anyway. Stay there."
She was in a small hallway, where there stood one flimsy-looking cane chair. She waited till he came back with the water, and said, "I didn't mean to..."
"Never mind. Come in here. It's not very tidy, but at least the chairs are comfortable."
He opened a door into a room that seemed to be part study and part junk shop, where books lay everywhere, including on the floor. She was reminded of the house of Kubicek in Prague. How long ago that seemed. The priest moved a dozen books from an armchair.
"You take this chair," he said. "The springs are still intact."
She sat down and watched as he distributed the books into three separate piles, corresponding, she supposed, to three aspects of the subject he was reading about, which seemed to be philosophy. His robin demon was perching on the back of the other armchair, watching her with bright eyes. Burnaby sat down and said,
"Obviously you need some medical attention. Let's take that as read. I'll give you the address of a good doctor in a minute. Now, tell me what else you need, apart from a demon. We'll take that as read too. How can I help?"
"Where are we? This is Seleucia, I know that much, but is it far from Aleppo?"
"A few hours by motor. The road isn't very good, though. Why do you want to go there?"
"I want to meet someone there."
"I see," he said. "May I know your name?"
"Tatiana Provoskaya."
"Have you tried the Muscovite consul?"
"I'm not a Muscovite. Only my name is."
"When did you arrive in Seleucia?"
"Late last night. It was too late to find a hotel. I was looked after very kindly by some poor people."
"When were you attacked?"
"On the train from Smyrna, by some soldiers."
"Have you seen a doctor at all?"
"No. I've spoken to no one except the people who helped me, and we had no language in common anyway."
"What were their names?"
"Childu and Yozdar."
"A night soilman and his wife."
"Do you know them?"
"No, but their names are not Anatolian, they're Tajik. They mean 42, the man, and 11, the woman."
"Tajik?" she said.
"Yes. They're not allowed to have personal names, so they're given numbers instead. Even for the men, odd for the women."
"That's horrible. Are they slaves or something?"
"Something like that. They can take up only a limited number of occupations. Grave digging is a common one. And the night soil business."
"They were very kind. They gave me this veil, headscarf, this kneecap, is it?"
"You were wise to wear it."
"Mr. Burnaby, father, what should I call you?"
"Jerome, if you like."
"Jerome? What's happening here? Why are there soldiers on the street and in the train?"
"Oh, people are restless, frightened. There have been riots, arson, persecutions. Since the martyrdom of St. Simeon, the patriarch, there's been a sort of martial ecclesiastical law in force. The Rose Garden troubles are at the bottom of it all.
Lyra thought about that. Then she said, "The people, last night, they had no demons, like me."
"May I ask how you were deprived of your demon?"
"He vanished. That's all I know."
"You're lucky not to be stopped this morning. Those without demons, often Tajiks, are not allowed to be seen in the hours of daylight. If they'd thought you were a Tajik, you would have been arrested."
Lyra sat still for a moment and said, "This is a horrible place."
"I can't deny that." She sipped the water. "And you want to get to Aleppo?" he said.
"Would it be hard to do that at the moment?"
"Well, this is a trading city. You can find anything here for money. But it will be more expensive now, such a journey, than it would be in peaceable times."
"Have you heard of a place," she said, "called the Blue Hotel? A place where lost demons go?"
His eyes widened. "Oh, please, be careful," he said, and actually got up out of his chair and patrolled the room, looking out of both windows, one facing the street and the other the narrow vegetable garden next to the house. His robin demon was twittering her alarm and flew towards Lyra before turning and making for the safety of the priest's shoulder.
"Be careful about what?" Lyra said. She was a little bewildered.
"The place you mentioned. There are powers that are not of this world, spiritual powers, evil powers. I really do advise you not to go there."
"But I'm trying to find my demon. You know I am. If the place exists, then he might be there. I must go and try. I'm incomplete. You must see that."
"You don't know that your demon is there. Look, I have seen cases. I could tell you of examples of real spiritual evil arising in places where, among people who... Oh, no. I really do counsel you not to go there, even if it does exist."
"Even if? But you mean it might not exist?"
"If such a place did exist, it would be wrong to go there."
Lyra thought, "Is this Bolvanger again?"
But she couldn't waste time telling him about that.
"If I were asking," she said, "as a, I don't know, simply as a journalist or something, if I were asking how one might get there, if one wanted to, would you tell me?"
"Well, in the first place, I don't know how to get there. It's all rumour, myth, maybe even superstition. But I expect your friend, the night soil man, might know, if anyone would. Why don't you ask him?"
"Because we can't speak each other's language. Look, never mind. I haven't got the strength to go anywhere at the moment. Thank you for listening, and for the glass of water."
"I'm sorry. Don't feel you have to go. I'm only concerned for your welfare, spiritual and..."
"Sit here and rest. Stay a while. I really think you should let a doctor have a look at your injuries." "I'll be all right, but I've got to go now. But I wish there was something you'd let me do." "All right," she said. "Just tell me about travel between here and Aleppo. Is there a train?"
"There used to be. Till quite recently, in fact, but they've stopped allowing them. There is a bus, twice a week, I think. But
is there any other way of getting there?"
He drew in his breath, tapped his fingers, shook his head. "There are camels," he said.
"Where would I find a camel? And someone to guide me?"
"Well, you realize that this city is a terminus of many of the Silk Road trails. The great markets and warehouses are in Aleppo, but a substantial number of goods come here to be taken onwards by sea. And there's inward trade as well. Train masters load their camels here for journeys as far as Peking. Aleppo is just a step for them. If you go to the harbour, that's what I do, go to the harbour and ask for a train master. Oh, they speak every language under the sun. Forget the other idea, I do beg you. It's moonshine. Deluding. Dangerous, really. By camel, Aleppo would be 2 days or so away. Maybe three. Have you got friends there?"
"Yes," she said easily. "Once I get there, I'll be safe."
"Well, I wish you good luck. Sincerely. And remember, the Authority never wishes for his creation to be split apart. You were created with a demon, and he is somewhere now, longing to be reunited with you. When that happens, nature will be restored a little, and the Authority will be happy."
"Is he happy that those poor Tajik people have to live like that?"
No, no. The world is not an easy place, Tatyana. There are trials, we assent. She stood up, surprised at the effort it took, and had to hold on to the back of her chair. You're not well, he said, and his tone was gentle. No. He stood too, and clasped his hands together. His face was expressing a whole sequence of thoughts and feelings, and he even made a curious writhing movement as if he wanted to burst out of chains or shackles. What is it? Lyra said. He said, sit down again. I haven't told you the truth. Please, sit down. I shall try. He was plainly moved. He was struggling against something, and at the same time ashamed to reveal it. Lyra sat down, watching every expression that came and went on the priest's face. Your Tajik friends, he said quietly. Their demons will have been sold. She wasn't sure she'd heard him. What? Did you say sold? People sell their demons? It's poverty, he said. There's a market for demons. Medical knowledge here is quite advanced, unlike other things. Big corporations are behind it. They say the medical companies are experimenting here before expanding into the European market. There's a surgical operation. Many people survive it now. Parents will sell their children's demons for money to stay alive. It's technically illegal, but big money brushes the law aside. When the children grow up, they're not full citizens, being incomplete. Hence their names and the occupations they have to take up. There are dealers. I know where. I can even tell you where to find them. This is not knowledge I'm proud of transmitting. In fact, every bone in my body is rebelling. I can't forgive myself for knowing this. There are men who can supply a demon for those who are without one. It sounds atrocious. It sounds absurd. When I first heard about it, when I moved to this living to look after this chapel, I thought it was something fit only for the confessional, and I admit I suffered. I struggled to believe it. But I have heard it from several quarters. People tell priests things like this. It seems that if a person, such as yourself, who has suffered in this way, suffered the loss of a demon, if such a person has enough money, they can call on the services of a dealer who will supply them with... will sell them a demon who will pass as their own. I have seen a few people in that condition. They have a demon. She, he... goes everywhere with them, appears to be close and understanding. But...
You can tell,
said his own Robin demon. Her voice was sweet and quiet.
They'll look disconnected, in some deep way. It's very disturbing.
I struggled with this, the priest went on, struggled to understand it, and come to terms with it. But... my bishop gave me no guidance. The magisterium denies that this is happening, but I know it is.
It's not possible, said Lyra, surely. Why would any demon agree to pretend to belong to someone else? They're us. A part of us. I mean, they must miss us just as we miss them. Have you ever been separate from your demon?
He shook his head. His demon said something quietly, and he took her in both hands and brought her close to his face.
And why do the demons stay with strangers? How could they bear it?
It might be better than to remain where they are, where they've been severed.
And dealers, Lyra went on. Is this allowed? Are they licensed or something?
I've heard, he began. And then, this is speculation and rumour, you understand. Well... some of the demons they sell are those removed from the Tajiks. The majority of them die, apparently, but... and this is very much an underground, you know, illicit sort of transaction. The authorities turn a blind eye to it because the corporations behind it are more powerful than politics now. Oh, you spoke the truth when you said this was a horrible place, Tatyana.
"Tell me more about the Blue Hotel," said Lyra. He looked unhappy.
"Please," she added. "I've come a very long way to find my demon. If he's anywhere near here, then I must keep him away from those dealers. And if the Blue Hotel is a place where demons go, it must be safe for them. Where is it? What is it? What do you know about it?"
He sighed. "People keep away from it," he said, "out of fear. I do believe there are evil powers involved. As far as I've heard, I had one parishioner who went to look for it out of curiosity, and he came back marked, changed, diminished. It's not a hotel. That's just a euphemism. It's a dead town. One of hundreds. I have no idea why it's known as the Blue Hotel, but something rules there. Something attracts demons. Maybe demons who've been severed and then escaped. It is not a good place, Tatiana. I'm convinced of that. Please don't.
Where can I find one of these dealers?"
He put his head in his hands and cried, "I wish I had said nothing."
"I'm glad you did. Where can I find them?
Everything about this is illegal, immoral. Everything is dangerous, both legally and spiritually. Do you understand what I mean?"
"Yes, but I still want to know. Where do I go? What do I ask for? Do they have a special name for these people, for this transaction?"
"Are you determined to do this?"
"It's the only clue I've had. Yes, of course I'm determined. And so would you be. These people who buy demons, how do they find the dealers? Please, Mr. Burnaby, Jerome, if you don't tell me everything you know, I might fall into even more danger. Is there a special place they go to, a particular marketplace, a cafe, something like that?"
He murmured something, and Lyra was about to ask him to say it again when she realized that he was talking to his demon, and it was the demon who answered.
"There is a hotel near the docks," she said. "It's called the Park Hotel, though there's no park nearby. People in your condition do go there and take rooms for a few days. Dealers will hear about it and call on them. The hotel management is discreet, but they charge a high price." "Park Hotel," Lyra repeated. "Thank you. I'll go there. What street is it in?"
"A back street called Osman Sokak," said Burnaby, "near the swing bridge." Osman Sokak. An alley, really." Lyra stood up. This time she felt steadier.
"I'm most grateful," she said. "Thank you, Mr. Burnaby."
"I can imagine how difficult it must be to find yourself in your position, but I beg you, please, simply go home."
"There's nothing simple about going home."
"No," he said. It was too easy to say. "And I'm not going to buy a demon. That would be a horrible transaction. Oh, I should never." He shook his head and went on. "If at any point you need help, please, call on me."
"That's kind of you. I'll remember. But I'll go now, Father Burnaby."
She remembered the veil with a sigh. She carefully arranged it across the bridge of her nose and around the back and over the top of her head, tucking the ends inside. She checked herself in the mirror over his hall table. It looked neat enough. And safe. And nullifying. She shook the priest's hand and left the coolness of his house for the heat of the morning, and began to walk doggedly towards the docks. She could see the tall necks of cranes in the quivering distance, and possibly the masts of ships as well, so that was clearly the way to go.
"Osman Sokak," she repeated to herself.
If she hadn't already discovered that this city was a less agreeable place than Smyrna, the walk to the docks would have convinced her. No one seemed to have ever had the thought of planting a tree or cultivating some bushes or even a patch of grass, or of making the neighborhoods places for pleasure or comfort, and not just stony-hearted business. The sun blazed down on the dusty streets with nothing to mitigate its glare. There were no benches to rest on, not even at the infrequent bus stops, and no cafes either, it seemed. If you wanted to rest, you would have to sit on the ground and find what shade you could between the buildings, most of which were blank-faced factories or warehouses or dingy apartment blocks. The only shops were small and functional, their goods laid out with a casual indifference in the full sun, vegetables wilting in the heat, or bread gathering the dust of the traffic. The citizens moved about without looking at one another, their heads down, unwilling to acknowledge anyone or anything. And everywhere patrols. The police cruising slowly in their blue vans, soldiers on foot, sauntering, guns held across their chests. Through it all, increasingly weary and painful and oppressed, Lyra moved grimly towards the docks. When she found the little back street called Osman Sokak, she was nearly ready to weep. But she managed to keep her composure as she entered the shabby building that called itself Pa Hotel, the K having fallen off and disappeared. The desk clerk was both torpid and sullen, but a flash of reptilian interest seemed to spark deep in his lizard demon's eyes as she noticed that Lyra had no demon. No doubt the clerk would earn a commission when he spread the word that a customer had arrived. He gave Lyra the key to a room on the first floor and left her to find the way herself. Once inside the hot little room, she tore off the veil and flung it into the corner and lay down carefully on the bed. Carefully, because her injuries were merging into a single great pain, which felt not as if it were in her, but as if she were in it. She felt sick and desolate. After crying a little, she fell asleep. She woke an hour later to find tears still on her cheeks, and to hear someone knocking at the door. "Wait a moment," she called, and hastily arranged the veil. She opened the door a little way. A middle-aged man in a suit stood there, with a briefcase in one hand. "Yes," she said.
"You are English, mademoiselle."
"Yes."
"I am in a position to help you."
"Who are you?"
"My name is Selim Veli. In fact, Dr. Selim Veli."
"What are you offering?"
"You do not have something very necessary, and I can supply what you need. May I come into your room and explain?"
His own demon was a parrot, who was watching Lyra from his shoulder with her head cocked. Lyra wondered if she was really his own demon, or one that he himself had bought, and knew that she would normally be able to tell at once, but all her certainties were dissolving now. "Wait a moment," she said, and shut the door before making sure her stick was near to hand. She opened the door again and let him in. He was formal and correct in manner, and his clothes were clean and recently pressed, and his shoes gleamed.
"Please sit down, Dr. Veli," she said.
He took the only chair, and she sat on the bed.
"I don't know whether this is conventionally approved of," she said, "but I'm not used to wearing a niqab, and I'm going to take this one off."
He nodded gravely. His eyes widened a little when he saw her injured face, but he said nothing.
"Tell me what you came for," she said.
"The loss of a demon is a grave event in anyone's life. In many cases, it is even fatal. The need exists for a supplier of what is wanted by those who have no demon, and I can fulfill that need."
"I want to find my demon."
"Of course you do. And I hope with all my heart that you are successful. How long has he been gone?"
"About a month."
"And you are still in good health, apart from..."
He gestured delicately towards her face.
"Yes." "Then there is every likelihood that your demon will be too. What is his name, and what form does he have?"
"Pantalaimon. He's a pine marten, a tree-dwelling rodent." "Where'd you acquire the demons that you sell?"
"They come to me. It is a purely voluntary transaction. There are dealers, I regret to say, who buy and sell demons taken by force or without consent."
"You mean the demons that belong to the poor Tajiks?"
"Tajiks, yes. Sometimes others. They are regarded with disgust and scorn for selling their demons. But if you have seen how poor people are forced to live, you will not withhold your compassion. I have nothing to do with that business. I will not touch it."
"So your demons came by themselves?"
"I represent only demons who have freely decided to sever their previous connection."
"And how much do you charge?"
It depends on the age, the appearance, the form. Other characteristics come into play as well. Languages spoken, social background. We aim for a close match, you see. There is always the risk that the person from whom the demon was severed will die, in which case the demon also will pass away. I can offer an insurance policy against that, which will cover the cost of a replacement.
Lyra was sickened, but made herself say, "And what is the price?"
"For a demon of the highest quality, closely matched, the price would be $10,000.
"And the very cheapest?"
"Oh, I do not deal in poor quality demons. Other dealers would charge you less, no doubt. You would have to engage with them."
"But if I were to bargain with you?"
"Ah, a price is a number on which we must both agree."
His manner was that of a high-class merchant discussing the purchase of a fine work of craftsmanship. "And how do people get on with their new demons?" she said.
"Every case is different, of course. Clients take a risk. With goodwill on both sides, a satisfactory arrangement can be reached in time. The aim is a modus vivendi, which will pass muster in normal social circumstances. The perfect oneness and sympathy that each party has lost, that they had from birth, I would be lying if I said that was always reached, but a sort of satisfactory tolerance and even, in time, affection is certainly possible."
Lyra stood up and walked to the window. The afternoon was a long way advanced. The pain she felt was not in the least abated. The heat was nearly intolerable.
"In the nature of this kind of transaction," the dealer continued, "there can hardly be any possibility of advertising. But it may be of interest to you to know the names of some satisfied clients."
"Well, who have you sold demons to?"
"To Signor Amedea Cipriani, the chairman of the Banco Genovese, to Madame Françoise Guilbault, Secretary General of the European Forum for Economic Understanding, to Professor Gottfried Brander."
"What? To Brander?"
"As I said, Professor Gottfried Brander, the distinguished German philosopher."
"I've read his books. He's a profound skeptic."
"Even skeptics need to move about in the world, to appear normal. I found him a fine German shepherd bitch, very like his own original demon, he told me."
"But him? Well, however did he come to lose his demon?"
"That was a private matter and no concern of mine."
"But in one of his books he says demons don't exist."
"That is a question to be discussed between him and his followers. I dare say he will not make public the fact that he has made this transaction."
"No," she said, feeling slightly dazed. "And how do the demons feel about being bought and sold?"
"They are in a condition of loneliness and desolation. They are grateful to be introduced to someone who will care for them."
Lyra tried to imagine Pan coming to this dealer, being sold to some lonely woman, trying to fit into a stranger's life, to feign affection, to receive confidences, all the while putting up with physical contact from someone who would always be a stranger. A lump came to her throat, and tears to her eyes, and she turned away for a moment.
"Well, I have another question," she said after a pause. "How can I get to the Blue Hotel?"
She turned back to see him a little surprised. He gathered himself almost at once and said,
"I have no idea. I have never been there myself. I am inclined to believe that no such place exists."
"But you have heard of it?"
"Of course. Rumor, superstition, gossip."
"Well, that's all I need to know. Goodbye, Dr. Valley."
"With your permission, I shall leave a small selection of photograms and my card."
He leaned forward and spread out some pictures on the bed.
"Thank you, and goodbye," she said.
With a bow, the dealer left. Lyra picked up one of the photograms. It showed a cat demon, his fur patchy and thin, standing in a silver cage. As far as she could tell, his expression was one of rage and defiance. Stuck to the bottom of the picture was a label on which some typed words said, "Name, Argulis. Age, 24. Languages spoken,
Tajik, Russian, Anatolian. Price on application. The card bore the dealer's name and an address in the city, and that was all. She tore it and all the pictures up and threw them in the waste paper basket. A few minutes later came another knock. She didn't bother with the veil this time. The dealer was an elderly Greek who made the same response when she asked about the Blue Hotel. He left within 5 minutes. The third came half an hour later. Again she said that she didn't want to buy a demon. All she wanted was to get to the Blue Hotel. He didn't know, so she said goodbye and shut the door. She was desperately uncomfortable, hot, hungry, thirsty, and a bad headache added to her other unhappinesses. Her broken hand was swollen and darkened and throbbing with pain. She sat and waited. An hour went past. She thought, the words got around that I don't want to buy a demon, and they've given up bothering to come. She felt half inclined to lie down and die, but her body wanted food and drink, and she took that to be a sign that her body at least wanted to go on living. She put on the veil and went out to buy some bread and cheese and some bottled water, and, if she could find any, some painkilling medication. Veiled though she was, the shopkeepers treated her with hostile suspicion. One refused to sell her anything and kept making gestures to ward off some evil influence, but another took her money and sold her what she wanted. When she returned to the hotel, she found a man waiting outside her room. The first three had been respectably dressed and conducted themselves like professional businessmen with valuable goods to sell. This man looked like a beggar. His clothes were little better than rags. His hands were ingrained with dirt, and he had a scar that began on his left cheek, passed across the bridge of his nose, and continued to his right ear, white, against the nut-brown, sunburned face. He could have been any age between 30 and 60. A scattering of grey stubble was all the hair he had, but his face was mobile and unlined. His eyes were intelligent and vivid, and he spoke in a light, swift voice, whose accent seemed a blend of the entire Levant. His demon was a gecko, sitting on his shoulder.
"Miss, I am so glad to see you. I have been waiting here without a pause. I know what you want. The word is out. Does the young lady want to buy a demon? No, she does not. Is she interested in visiting the Roman temple sites? Another day, maybe. Is she waiting for a merchant of gold or ivory or perfume or silk or dried fruit? No. I am going to anticipate your deepest desire, lady. I know what you want. Is it not true?"
Lyra said, "I want to open my door and sit down inside my room. I'm tired and hungry. If you want to sell me something, tell me what it is when I've eaten and rested."
"Oh, with the greatest of pleasure. I shall wait here. I shall not go away. Take as long as you need. Make yourself entirely comfortable, and then call on me, and I will serve you with all the honesty at my command."
He bowed and sank into a cross-legged pose against the wall of the corridor opposite her door. He put his palms together in a gesture that possibly meant respect, though there was a slight gleam of mockery in his eyes. She unlocked her door and went inside, locking it again before taking off the veil, and sat down with her bread and cheese and warm water, and swallowed two of the painkillers. She ate and drank, and felt a little better for it, and then washed her hands and face, and tidied her short hair before opening the door. He was still there, cross-legged, patient, and he stood up at once with a lithe energy.
"Very well," she said. "Come in and tell me what you have to sell." "Did you enjoy your meal, madam?"
he said when she'd shut the door. "No, but it was necessary to eat. What is your name?"
"Abdel Ionides, madam."
"Please sit down. Don't call me madam. You can call me Miss Silvertongue."
"Very good. That is a name expressive of personal qualities, and I dare to ask about the interesting people who must have been your parents."
"That name was given me by a king, not by my parents. Now, what have you got to sell?"
"Many things. I can supply almost anything. I have the almost to testify to my honesty. Now, most people who come to this hotel are in a sorry condition, having lost their demons but still remained alive. Their suffering is pitiable, and my heart is a warm and easily moved organ. So, if they ask me to find the demon, that is what I shall do. I have performed that task many times. May I say something about the condition of your health, Miss Silver?"
"What do you want to say?"
"You are in some pain. I have a truly marvelous salve from the most mysterious region of the deepest East, which is guaranteed to relieve pains of every kind and origin for only $10 equivalent. I can sell you this wonderful medication."
He took a small tin from his pocket, like the containers shoe polish came in, but smaller and unlabeled.
"Please, try just a small amount. You will be convinced, I assure you," he said, taking off the lid and holding it out.
The salve was pinkish in colour and greasy. She took a very small dab on the tip of her right forefinger and applied it to her broken hand. She couldn't feel any difference, but she didn't feel like arguing, and the price wasn't high. She paid the money, causing him a little surprise, and then she realized that he'd been expecting her to bargain. Well, too bad. She put the tin on the bedside table and said, "Do you know a man called..." She picked up the card left by her earlier visitor. "Dr. Salim Veli."
"Oh, indeed, a man of substance and renown."
"Is he honest?"
"That is like asking whether the sun is hot. Dr. Veli's honesty is a byword throughout the entire Levant. But do you mistrust him, Miss Silver?"
"He told me he had sold a demon to someone whose name I knew, and I was surprised. I didn't know whether to believe him."
"Oh, you can believe him without hesitation or fear."
"I see. How do those who sell demons acquire them?"
"Oh, there are many ways. I can see you are a lady of a tender heart, so I shall not tell you some of the ways in which this happens, but from time to time a demon will be lost, unhappy, even unwanted, if you can believe that dreadful truth, and we take him or her into our care and try to find a congenial companion for them in the hope of making a liaison that will last, after all, for a lifetime. When we are successful, the happiness we feel is almost equivalent to that of our lucky clients."
His gecko demon, orange and green in colour, scuttled briskly over his arms and shoulders and the top of his head. Lyra saw her slip out her tongue and lick the surface of her eyes, and then whisper a quick word or two in the man's ear. "Well," said Lyra, "I don't want a replacement for my demon. I want to go to Aleppo."
"I can guide you there with great facility and convenience, Miss Silver."
"And on the way I want to go somewhere else. I have heard of a place called the Blue Hotel."
"Ah, yes. I am familiar with that name, too. Sometimes we refer to it by the name of Selenopolis or Madinat al-Kamar. They are words that mean the city or the town of the moon."
"Do you know how to get there?"
"I have been there twice. I had not thought I would ever go there again, but I perceive the course of your thinking, and I dare to say we could agree a price for me to take you there. But it is not a pleasant place."
His gecko demon spoke from his left shoulder.
"It is horrible," she said, her voice high and quiet. "Our price will be high to pay for the suffering that I will undergo. For choice, we would never go there again. But if it is your will, then it will be our duty. I shall not say our pleasure."
"Is it far from here?"
"One, maybe 2 days' journey by camel," said Ionides.
"I've never ridden a camel."
"Then we shall have to teach you. But there is no other way, no road, no rail, only the desert."
"Very well. Then name your price."
$100.
"That's too high. It sounds like something worth 60.
"Oh, Miss Silver, you mistake the nature of this journey. This excursion to the world of the night is not just a matter of tourism. This is not a Roman temple or a ruined theatre with picturesque columns and fallen masonry and a little stall that sells lemonade and souvenirs. We shall be treading on the borders of the invisible, trespassing in the realm of the uncanny. Is this not worth a higher price than the sum you named, which would hardly cover the hire of one camel? Make it 90.
"Still too much. I can summon the uncanny whenever I want to. I have spent weeks of my life in the presence of the invisible and the uncanny. They are not strange to me. What I want is a guide to take me to this city or town or village of the night. I offer you $70.
"Alas, you want to travel like a beggar, Miss Silver, for a journey of this danger and consequence. It is a sign of respect to the inhabitants, and of respect to your humble guide, and not least of respect to your own demon, to travel in a manner that expresses the quality of your breeding and the width of your sympathies. $80.
She was tired. "All right, $80, she said. 25 before we start, 25 when we get to the Blue Hotel, and 30 when we get to Aleppo." He shook his head sadly. His demon, perching on it, kept her eyes on Lyra as his head moved.
"I am a poor man," he said, "and I shall still be a poor man after this journey. I had hoped to be able to save a little from this fee against the poverty of old age, but
I see that will be impossible. Nevertheless, you have my word. 30 for each stage of the journey, then.
No. 25, 25, and 30. He bowed his head. The demon jumped off and into his open hands and licked her eyes again.
When would you like to start?
Ionides said.
Chapter 33 The Dead Town. All the next day, Lyra rode her camel in a little enclosed tent of pain. Ionides managed everything with good humor and perfect tact. He knew when to be quiet, and when she wouldn't mind a friendly remark. He found somewhere shady to rest at noon, and made sure she kept drinking enough water. After their midday rest, he said,
"It is really and quite genuinely not far now, Miss Silver. I estimate that we shall arrive in the neighborhood of Madinat al-Kamar at about sunset."
"Have you ever been into the place?" she asked.
"No. To be immaculately candid, Miss Silver, I was afraid. You mustn't underappreciate the degree of fear that is aroused in persons who are complete at the thought of a company of separated demons, or of the process of separation that must have occurred."
"I don't under whatever the fear. I used to feel it myself. I've been causing it in other people for 2,500 miles.
"Yes, of course. I would never assume you didn't deeply and thoroughly know that. But the result of that emotional reaction is that I was too frightened to follow my clients into the purlieus of the Blue Hotel. I told them so with perfect frankness. They went in alone. I brought them there, but I never guaranteed the outcome of their search. All I guaranteed was to take them to the Blue Hotel, which I did, 100%. The rest was up to them."
She nodded. She was almost too tired to say anything. They rode on. The little part of Ionides' salve was in her pocket, and balancing as best she could, she prized it open and applied a dab to the back of her abominably aching hand, and then, experimenting, to her temples. The headache she'd had for days was still firmly in residence, and the glare from the sand all around was helping not at all. But a marvelous coolness quite soon began to soothe her brow, and the glare even seemed to dim slightly. "Mr. Ionides," she said, "tell me more about this salve."
"I bought it from a train master who had just arrived from Samarkand. Its virtues are quite well known, I assure you."
"Where does it originally come from?"
"Oh, who knows? Very much further east, beyond the highest mountains in the world. No camel trains make the journey through the mountain passes. It is too high and too arduous, even for camels. Anyone who wishes to transport goods from that side to this or this side to that has to negotiate with the Bagashkti."
"And what's that? Or they?"
"They are beings who are like humans in that they have a language and can speak, but unlike us in that if they have a demon, it is internal or invisible. They are like small camels, no hump, long neck. They hire themselves out for purposes of transport. Bad-tempered, very unpleasant, oh, I can't tell you, arrogant, but they can climb the high passes with loads of unbelievable size."
"So if this salve came from beyond the mountains..."
"It will have been carried part of the way by the Bagashkti. But the Bagashkti have another virtue. The mountains are infested with large birds of a carnivorous rapacity, which are known as Ogabgorgs. Enormously dangerous. Only the Bagashkti have found a way of fighting off these birds. The Bagashkti can spit their offensive and venomous saliva very accurately for a not inconsiderable distance. The birds find this not at all enjoyable and quite commonly retreat. So, in paying for the services of the Bagashkti, a trainmaster will also ensure his survival and that of the goods he carries. But, as you will realize, Miss Silver, it adds to the cost. May I ask, how is your pain now?"
"It's slightly better, thank you. Tell me, did you know about this salve? Did you specifically ask for it?"
"Yes, I did know, and that is why I managed to find a merchant likely to have it."
"Has it got a special name?"
"It is called Gulmaron. But there are many cheap kinds that do not have any beneficial effects. This is the true Gulmaron."
"I'll remember that. Thank you." The pain in her hand was just about bearable, but, to add to all the other discomforts, she began to feel a familiar, deep, dragging ache low in her belly. Well, it was due. There was even something reassuring in it. "If that part's working, then at least my body's still in good order," she thought. But it was uncomfortable nonetheless, and she was profoundly glad when the sun touched the horizon and Ionides said it was time to make camp. "Are we there?" she said. "Is this the Blue Hotel?" Looking around, she saw a low range of hills, not even hills, not much more than rocky slopes to the right, and endless flat desert to the left. Directly ahead was a mass of broken stone, with little to show at a first glance that there had ever been a town there, though the last rays of the sun did illuminate the top of a line of columns made of light-colored limestone much eroded by wind, which she might not have noticed otherwise. While Ionides bustled around tethering the camels and making a fire, Lyra climbed the nearest rock and looked steadily into the mass of jumbled boulders, and in the rapidly fading light, she did begin to make out some regular shapes, a rectangular set of tumbled walls, an arch that had tilted slightly without actually falling, a paved open space that might have been a market or forum. It was all lifeless. If there were any demons there, they were hiding well and keeping very quiet. "Are you sure this is the right place?" she said, joining Ionides at the fire, where he was grilling some kind of meat.
"Miss Silver," he said in a tone of deep reproach, "I did not think of you as a die-hard skeptic."
"Not a die-hard one, but just a little cautious. Is this the place?"
"Guaranteed. There are the remains of the town, all those rocks. They used to be buildings. Even now some of the walls are still standing. You have only to walk among them to know that you are in what used to be a center of commerce and culture."
She stood watching the shadows lengthen, as Ionides turned the meat and mixed some flour with a little water and slapped the dough flat before cooking it in a long blackened frying pan. By the time the food was ready, the sky was nearly dark.
"A good sleep, Miss Silver, and you will be awake bright and early to investigate the ruins in the morning," he said.
"I'm going in tonight."
"Is that altogether 100% wise?"
"I don't know. But it's what I want to do. My demon is in there, and I want to find him as soon as possible."
"Of course you do, but there may be other things than demons in there."
"What things?"
"Phantoms, ghasts of this kind or that, emissaries of the evil one."
"Do you believe that?"
"Of course. It would be an intellectual failure to do anything else."
"There are philosophers who say that the failure would be to believe. Not to disbelieve."
"Then excuse me, Miss Silver, but they have separated their intelligences from their other faculties, and that is not an intelligent thing to do."
She said nothing at first, because she agreed with him. Agreed instinctively, if not yet intellectually. Part of her was still enthralled to the cast of mind of Talbot and Brander. But it came to her clearly as she swallowed the last of the tender meat and the hot bread, how incongruous it was to bring any of that university skepticism to the Blue Hotel. "Mr. Ionides, have you ever heard the term the secret commonwealth?"
"No. What does it refer to?"
"To the world of half-seen things and half-heard whispers. To things that are regarded by clever people as superstition. To fairies, spirits, hauntings, things of the night. The sort of thing you said the Blue Hotel is full of."
"The secret commonwealth?
No, I have never heard the expression." "Perhaps there are other names for it."
"I am sure there are many."
He wiped the frying pan around with the last of the bread and ate it slowly. Lyra was so tired she felt on the verge of delirium. She wanted to sleep quite desperately, but she knew that if she gave in and put her head down, she wouldn't wake up till the morning was filling the sky. Ionides pottered about their little camp, covering the fire, gathering his blankets, rolling a smoke-leaf cigarette. Finally, he settled down to huddle in the dark shade of a camel-sized rock. Only the tiny glow of his cigarette showed he was there at all. Lyra stood up, feeling every one of the separate pains and injuries. The hand was worst. She took a very little of the rose salve on her right forefinger and rubbed it in as gently as a butterfly landing on a grass blade. Then she put the salve in her rucksack with the alethiometer and stepped away from the fire and towards the tumbled ruins. The moon was climbing the sky, and the vast sweep of the Milky Way stretched above. Every one of those minute specks a sun in its own system. Lighting and warming planets, maybe, and life, maybe, and some kind of wandering being, maybe, looking out at the little star that was her sun and at this world, and at Lyra. Ahead of her, the dead bones of the town lay almost white in the moonlight. Lives had been spent here. People had loved one another and eaten and drunk and laughed and betrayed and been afraid of death, and not a single fragment of that remained. White stones, black shadows. All around her things were whispering, or it might only have been night-loving insects conversing together. Shadows and whispers. Here was the tumbled ruin of a little basilica. People had worshipped here. Nearby, a single archway topped with a classical pediment stood between nothing and nothing. People had walked through the arch, driven donkey carts through, stood and gossiped in its shade in the heat of a long dead day. There was a well, or a fountain, or a spring. At any rate, someone had thought it worth cutting stones and forming a cistern, and a representation of a nymph above it, now blurred and smoothed by time, the cistern dry, the only trickle that of the insect sounds. So she walked on, further and further into the silent moonscape of the city of the moon, the Blue Hotel. And Olivier Bonneville watched. He was lying among some rocks on the slope nearest the little camp. He had been there since shortly after Lyra and Ionides had arrived. He was watching through binoculars as Lyra picked her way among the stones of the dead town, and beside him lay a loaded rifle. He had made himself as comfortable as he could be without a fire. His camel knelt some way behind, chewing something resistant and appearing to think deeply. The view Bonneville had of Lyra was the first time he had ever seen her in the flesh. He was taken aback by how different she looked from the photogram, the short, dark hair, the tense and strained expression, the obvious exhaustion and pain in every movement. Was it the same girl? Had he mistakenly followed someone else? Could she have changed this much in less than a month? He half wanted to follow her right into the ruins and confront her close to. At the same time, he feared to do that, guessing that it would be much easier to shoot someone from a distance, in the back, than to do it when they were close and face to face. He considered the man who was with her, the camel man, the guide, to be a slight nuisance, but no more than that. A few dollars would pay him off. Lyra was still brightly visible in the moonlight, an easy target as she picked her slow way through the stones. Bonneville was a good shot. The Swiss were keen on such things as military service and hunting and marksmanship, but if he wanted to shoot her cleanly, he had better do it before she moved very far into the Blue Hotel. He put down the binoculars and took the rifle, carefully, silently, knowing everything about its weight and its length and the feeling of the stock against his shoulder. He lowered his head to look along the barrel, and moved his hips a fraction of an inch to settle himself more securely. Then he had a horrible shock. There was a man lying next to him, and looking at him, no more than 3 feet to his left. He actually gasped aloud, "Ah!" and twisted away involuntarily, and his demon burst up into the air, flapping her wings in panic. The man didn't move, in spite of the way the rifle barrel was waving wildly in Bonneville's shaking hands. He was monstrously, inhumanly calm. His gecko demon sat on a rock just behind him, licking her eyeballs.
"Who? Where did you come from?"
said Bonneville hoarsely. He spoke in French by instinct. His demon glided down to his shoulder. The camel man, Lyra's guide, replied in the same language.
"You didn't see me because you took your eyes off the whole picture. I've been watching you for 2 days. Listen, if you kill her, you'll be making a big mistake. Don't do it. Put your gun away." "Who are you?" "Abdelionides, put the rifle down now. Put it down."
Bonneville's heart was hammering so hard that he thought it must be audible. The blood pounded in his head as he made his hands relax and push the rifle away. "What do you want?" he said. Ionides said,
"I want you to leave her alive for now. There is a great treasure, and she is the only one who can get it. Kill her now, and you'll never have it, and more importantly, neither will I."
"What treasure? What are you talking about?"
"You don't know. Again, what are you talking about? Where is this treasure? You don't mean her demon? Of course not. The treasure is 3,000 miles to the east, and as I said, no one can get it but her.
And you want her to get it so you can have it?
What do you think?
Why should I care what you want? I don't want treasure from 3,000 miles away. What I want is what she has now.
And if you take that, she will never find the treasure. Listen to me. I speak to you harshly, but I have to admire you. You are resourceful, courageous, hardy, inventive. I like all those qualities, and I want to see them rewarded. But at the moment, you are like the wolf in the fable who seizes the nearest lamb and arouses the shepherd. Your attention is in the wrong place. Wait and watch and learn and then kill the shepherd, and you will be able to have the entire flock.
You're speaking in riddles.
I am speaking in metaphor. You are intelligent enough to understand that.
Bonneville was silent for a few moments. Then he said, "What is this treasure, then?"
Ionides began to talk, quietly, confidently, confidentially. In the fable that Bonneville knew, it was a fox, but he enjoyed being compared to a wolf, and above all else, he enjoyed the praise of older men. As the moon rose higher, as Lyra in the distance slowly made her solitary way into the dead and demon-haunted town, Ionides went on talking, and Bonneville listened. When he looked at the dead city again, Lyra had vanished. She was out of sight because she turned to avoid a broken mass of gleaming marble that had once been a temple. There she found herself at one end of a colonnade, which cast black bars of shadow across the snow-white stone of the path. And there was a girl, sitting on a fallen piece of masonry, a girl of 16 or so, of North African appearance and shabby dress. She wasn't a phantom. She cast a shadow as Lyra herself did, and, like her, she had no demon. She stood up as soon as she saw Lyra. In the moonlight, she looked tense and full of fear.
"You are Miss Silvertongue," she said.
"Yes," said Lyra, astonished.
"Who are you?" "Nurhuda el-Wahhabi. Come on, come quickly. We have been waiting for you."
"We?
Who?"
"You don't mean..."
But Nurhuda tugged urgently at Lyra's right hand, and they hurried together along the colonnade, towards the heart of the ruins. Thus she there waited until eventide, yet living creature none she saw appear. And now sad shadows gan the world to hide from mortal view, and wrap in darkness drear. Yet nudged off her weary arms for fear of secret danger, nay let sleep oppress her heavy eyes with nature's burden dear, but drew herself aside in sickness, and her well-pointed weapons did about her dress. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen, Book 3, Canto 11, 55. To be concluded. Acknowledgements. I owe many people thanks for their help in writing this story, and I'll acknowledge them all in full at the end of the final book. But there are three debts I would like to pay now. One is to the great work of Catherine Briggs, Folk Tales of Britain, where I first read the story of the Dead Moon. The second is to the poet and painter Nick Messenger, from whose account of a voyage in the schooner Volga in his poem Sea Cow, I have borrowed the story of the phosphor bronze propeller. The third is to Robert Kirk, 1644 to 1692, whose wonder-filled book, The Secret Commonwealth, or an essay on the nature and actions of the subterranean and, for the most part, invisible people, heretofore going under the names of fauns and fairies or the like, among the Low Country Scots, as described by those who have second sight, has been an inspiration in many ways, not least in reminding me of the value of a good title. So I stole it, or some of it. There are three characters in this novel whose names are those of real people whose friends wanted to remember them in a work of fiction. One
is Bud Schlesinger, whom we saw first in La Belle Sauvage. The second is Alison Weatherfield, whom we shall see again in the final book. And the third is Nirhuda El-Wahhabi, who was one of the victims of the terrible fire at Grenville Tower. I'm privileged to be able to help commemorate them.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Dust, Volume 2, The Secret Commonwealth, by Philip Pullman. Read for you by Michael Sheen. This program was directed by Roy McMillan. Post-production was by Richard Hughes. Executive producer, James Keat. Text copyright 2019 by Philip Pullman. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.